Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network, where we bring together official Washington, D.C. insiders, policymakers, and AI experts who are challenging, debating, and just trying to figure out the rules of the road for artificial intelligence. It's so exciting to have you here tonight at the House of 1229 for this important conversation in partnership with Global Wind, the Global Women's Innovation Network. Come on now. Founded in 2009, special thanks to co-founder Helen Milby, Angelina Chawla, Global Wind's executive director. We partnered on this important conversation tonight with Global Wind, and my special guest, and she is a very special guest, is President Biden's Chief Science and Technology Advisor, Aarthi Prabhakar. Let's hear it for us. Okay. I'm going to totally digress. I'm sorry. But the last time I saw you, we were at the White House for the West Wing party, meaning the West Wing, the 25th anniversary.
Cool. That was so cool.
And you were up there and I heard someone say, you know, Aarthi's in the cabinet. And I'm like, yeah, I know. But it's such a tribute to this administration. We're going to get into it, that science and technology is so important. And you've done such a remarkable job. So you've been waving the flag on the importance of investing in American research and development. Welcome again to the Washington AI Network. And tell us what you're thinking about for research and development. First of all, let's give it a round.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks so much, Tammy.
It's wonderful to be here with all of you. Thank you so much for the invitation. Really appreciate it. We have this wonderful handbag in the audience with lights that are flashing that say V-O-T-E.
Yeah.
And I think all of you look at that and you see a fashion item, you see a thing about voting. I look at that and what I think is, do you know about the federal research and development that made that possible? And I'll tell you, it is in every part of our life. You know, if you use GPS to navigate around traffic, if you stream something over the internet, I have a friend who's in his 80s, and I've gotten so many more years of enjoyment and friendship with him because of a miracle cancer drug that didn't exist 10 years prior to when he needed it. How many people here are protected by the mRNA vaccine against COVID? Yeah. And think about the clean water that we drink and the clean air that we breathe, and think about how we understand the biodiversity on this beautiful blue planet that we live on. Every single thing I just told you was not possible without federal R&D. So the government support of research and development is just foundational to so many things. It's important for our economy and for jobs. It's important for national security. It's important for our health. This is how we thrive and how we build our future as a country. And so nurturing that and making sure that we're funding it and making sure it's doing the best job it possibly can, that's a lot of our focus at the Office of Science and Technology Policy at the White House. And the fun of doing this in this administration is working for a president. How many times have you all heard President Biden say that America is the one country that can be defined in a single word, and that word is possibilities? Well, that's what science and technology really is all about.
How did you get into all of this and get into the government?
Well, I was a first-generation Indian-American kid. I was raised in a house where my mom started sentences with, when you get your PhD, she was not joking. And I was halfway through getting a PhD in applied physics at Caltech when I realized that it was so useful to understand how research was done, but it is deep and narrow. And I'm an engineer at heart. I wanted to see how all the pieces fit together so that you could drive the future and make the future a better place than the present. And so on a lark, I came to Washington. You know how many people come to Washington for 1 year? Yes, I did. I came on a congressional fellowship 40 years ago this fall. I was at the old Office of Technology Assessment on Capitol Hill. And that was great fun. It mainly got me off that track I was on. What happened to me is when I left the track I was supposed to be on, that academic track, I got a chance to go to DARPA, the Defense Department's research agency. I was just like this wet behind the ears kid right out of graduate school. And I got this chance to go to DARPA and to run semiconductor programs. And then I ended up building a new office there, the first semiconductor office that they had there. And I just fell in love with the idea that you could use science and technology to do big things, work with this huge community, but that you've got to do it for your country. And I never really recovered from falling in love with that idea.
Let's talk about DARPA. And the fact that right now companies are a little bit farther ahead on generative AI, right, than government. Okay, we'll get there. But let's go back to DARPA. Sorry, there's so much to talk to you about. I'm just beside myself. So semiconductors. So now people have NVIDIA chips in their earrings, right? Did you ever think when you were working in semiconductors that it would drive really everything?
That's what I studied in graduate school. And 40 years ago, we were all excited about what semiconductors could do. The good news is all the things we were excited about came to pass, right? Because it's the backbone of the information age, our computers and our cell phones. It's the backbone of our military capabilities. We have the most powerful military capabilities. We can see farther, decide faster than anyone on the planet. You've got to have semiconductors to make that happen. We can have a clean energy transition. It's LEDs, but it's also the components that let you build clean power systems. So all the really amazing prospects of semiconductors, and think about these amazing AI systems that NVIDIA and others are powering, all of that happened. And of course, there was a dark side, and the dark side was that while those marvelous things were happening for leading edge semiconductor manufacturing, first it globalized, started in the US, globalized, and then it got so dangerously concentrated in just one part of the world, in Taiwan. That was a vulnerability we saw. I mean, I've been thinking about and working on and trying to hope and praying that something was going to happen in this area for 40 years. It's not news. We saw this happening. But in the pandemic, when people couldn't get semiconductor components and that shut down car factories in Detroit, and I was trying to get a new dryer, my washer and dryer needed upgrade, and I couldn't get the model I wanted. And I thought, well, that's annoying. I was annoyed. There were people who were out of work because you couldn't get the chips that you needed. And I think that became a crystallizing moment where people said, wait a minute, this is terrible. It's inconvenient. It's hitting our economy. But these are the same chips that we need for our national security capabilities. The president really made chips and science the important bill that got passed. He made that a priority. It passed on a bipartisan basis, and we finally are doing the work to make sure we have leading-edge semiconductor manufacturing back in the U.S.
And you were there right when the Samsung, okay, you can applaud.
They're here.
By the way, what a crowd applauding semiconductors. The history of
that this. Just makes me really happy.
Because we want you to be happy. Now, I'm just thinking about, you go from semiconductors, right? And then you've got, I mean, I hate to like make this fast forward, but then, because we had Ted Leonsis here last week and Grant Verstandig, and Ted Leonsis told this story about taking Jeff Bezos when he had the venture fund and taking him to Wax Pool Road. How many people have been there? Okay, Elizabeth Falcone from Senator Warner's office. Okay, and he told this story, how they stood right at the corner and said, can you feel it? And he said, what's that? 80% of the internet traffic was right between their feet. I think we should have a field trip there, Elizabeth.
We're welcoming you to the Commonwealth.
Right. Thank you very much. But that technology, I mean, that was you. You were ever at DARPA. You kind of helped make all that happen.
You know,
right?
When I was DARPA director later in my career, people would thank me for the internet. And I would say, I was 9 years old, but you are welcome.
Are they thanking you for AI now?
Yeah. Oh, thank you. DARPA definitely did a lot of the early groundwork.
One, two, three. Thank you, Army. There we go. That's great. Okay. So now we have these semiconductors. We've got NVIDIA's rocket, right?
There's so much to say about artificial intelligence. It was moving fast, and then it moved astonishingly fast when generative AI burst on the scene. And I'll tell you what I think really happened is AI was already in our lives in all kinds of ways, but it was behind the price you got for an airline ticket, or it was behind the yay or nay on your mortgage application. And then when generative AI, when that moment happened and all of a sudden it was chatbots and image generators like you just described, all of a sudden it wasn't hidden anymore and people saw it immediately in front of them. And that created such a powerful moment, which is exactly what the president and the vice president seized to start doing the work to get us on the right track for AI.
Well, that's right. So AI comes out. First, you've got chips, and we're talking about semiconductors. Then the next thing you know, you are meeting with the vice president as well as the president. What is her view, or can you tell us a little bit about those meetings?
Sure. I'll start with the vice president. In the body of work that we've been doing on AI, she's just been very focused on it throughout this whole period. I should back up and say I started in this job in October of 2022. ChatGPT came out in November of 2022. And then just this rocket ship of activity got launched. And it was such a privilege to get to be right in the middle of all of that. It involved so many people across the White House and across the government and a much broader community. But having that moment to introduce ChatGPT and image generators to the president, to get to work with the vice president, has just really been a privilege. The vice president early on hosted a group of CEOs who came together. We invited them early on. I think this was in May of 2023. That was a meeting that led to voluntary commitments because the vice president said to those CEOs, you have not just a legal obligation, but a moral obligation to make sure your products are safe before they go out into the world. I think that was extremely powerful. A few weeks later, she convened a group of civil society organizations. We had labor leaders, we had consumer protection organizations, we had civil rights organizations. And of course, she has such a deep background on technology, and as AG in the state of California, of course, she was very familiar with the issues. But watching her interrogate people and really understand how AI was coming into people's lives, what the implications were, what could we really do about it? I got to moderate that discussion. It was just really fun to watch her in action.
Oh, I bet. That sounds really incredible. You're making a lot of decisions, bringing people together, but it's all changing in real time. So did you wake up every morning and you got emails from all the companies, hey, guess what we did?
Oh, yeah. And I mean, we all see it, right? Because for a long period, it's still continuing. Every time you turn around, there's another advance. I'll tell you, the thing that really helped me is a decade ago when I was running DARPA, if you lived in the technical world, AI was definitely having this huge resurgence. There was an early era of AI. We don't even call it AI anymore. It's expert systems that are just part of life. You don't think of it as AI. But this machine learning generation sounds like magic. All you're doing is taking a very powerful computer, you're training it on a lot of data, and then it learns patterns and it learns how to make statistical predictions about what comes next, whether it's text or pixel to pixel or whatever it is you're trying to generate. So it doesn't sound that complicated. It's phenomenally powerful. It's phenomenally broad. And that's where I think a lot of the excitement comes from, appropriately. But what I saw a decade ago at DARPA, long before this generative AI with chatbots and image generators, I saw how that was happening in one field after another, how we have so much data in this information age that we're in. And every time there's a huge pile of data and you start cranking on it and trying to build machine learning models, over and over again, you just start getting insights that you could never have imagined before. And then you're off to the races. We used it to figure out how to manage spectrum more effectively. We used it to build a self-driving ship that could leave the port and navigate across open oceans for months at a time without a single sailor on board. So we were using it in all kinds of different ways. And so when I came back into public service, into this role, then this huge generative AI surge happened. But I felt like I had my sea legs because I had seen it and understood the technology and seen the breadth of applications and how fast they move.
So now we have this technology and you're the leading science advisor, you're a cabinet secretary. How do you get the federal government, all the employees, to be up to speed on AI? And how do you decide what to invest in?
Yeah. Well, the place to start is exactly the true north that the president and the vice president set, which is to say the most powerful technology of our times. We know about powerful technologies. They all come with bright sides and dark sides. And so the task that they laid out for the country was to say we have to manage AI's risks in order to seize its benefits. You want both. You have to be aggressive about managing risks and seizing benefits. And they are linked because people aren't going to trust and want to use this technology.
Well, that's what I always worry about. Risk. And the people don't trust it. It's not my technology. It's a bunch of rich people or Washington insiders. Yeah. They have the technology.
Well, if that's where we end up, then AI is not going to work for society. So that's exactly what the issues are. That was the starting point. And then when you're wrangling something as powerful and as broad as AI, everyone likes to work on their particular issue. But the power here is the fact that it's so broad. So, you know, it can be much more efficient for all kinds of processing, but it can embed bias in loans or in healthcare decisions. It can really exacerbate our privacy issues. You have to think about that when you're thinking about the efficiency. We know it can help workers do more and earn more, but we also know that it can absolutely suck all the value out of work and lead to job loss. So we've got some big choices to make sure we choose to use it in the right ways. And I'll tell you, the most important thing I will tell you about AI is we all love to admire the technology. What matters is people. It's who decides what to build, what to train it on, what to use it for. Those are very human choices. And that's why I think there's a huge opportunity. But it's on us, right? You can't just sort of shrug and say the technology is going to do it.
So there's a U.S. Safety Institute that's in Commerce. You've got the Secretary of Commerce. And then you have you guys and the voluntary commitments. We have people from industry here. What is the process for the technology to make sure there are no harms? I mean, are you giving advice to them? Are they reporting to you? How does that relationship work? I'm not talking about 6 months ago. I'm talking about today, yeah. Right? Because everything's kind of changed.
Yeah. So let's talk about where we are now with the work that has gotten done over the last year, year and a half. So first of all, it's all hands on deck. And those voluntary commitments from AI companies, which many companies now have signed up to, that's one part of the industry. And this is the first time leading AI companies have ever come together. We called on industry to step up to that set of commitments. We have worked with and will continue to work with Congress on a bipartisan basis. You've seen a number of measures that have been explored and things we hope will come together. We're eager to see what Majority Leader Schumer is able to do with the AI team that he's been able to put together. I think there's huge opportunity to get real progress there. We've worked on the global stage with our allies and partners, introducing the first ever resolution about AI at the UN General Assembly, which was adopted after, I think, we had 122 co-sponsors. So just
yeah,
getting
I don't know how
on
you
the
did
right
that.
Track.
That's
great to get that kind of alignment. So that's about the world and about industry and about Congress. But the president was also really clear that in the executive branch that his administration needed to move out and take our actions. And that resulted in the executive order that he signed just almost exactly a year ago, last October. That was a very, again, a broad EO reflecting the fact that this is a broad set of applications and implications. And all kinds of good work has come out of that. The Office of Management and Budget has put out guidance to all agencies about how they use AI. It has put guardrails in place for how we protect privacy, how we mitigate against bias when the government uses or buys AI systems. All of that is getting implemented today. There's been work on so many fronts. I'm going to cut to the chase because I think what matters is how does it change the lives of Americans? So today, when you go into a bank, if you apply for a mortgage or a loan or a credit card, almost always there's an AI system that's deciding yes or no. Today, because of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau's new rules, you are owed an explanation that you were not previously owed. So that's a great example of transparency. It tells you what you need to do to get the loan or credit card that you need. It used to be, we've had examples where people go in for medical care. Black maternal mortality statistics are terrible, in part because bad healthcare decisions that were made about people of a particular color from a particular neighborhood, particular income level, those bad decisions had gotten distilled in AI algorithms. So, I mean, the absolute worst thing is all the biased decisions of the past distilled into an algorithm so that you can be very efficient about continuing to make bad healthcare decisions. That's no longer acceptable because Health and Human Services now has a rule that says those AI algorithms have to be tested before and during the use in healthcare decisions. And the FTC put out a rule that says that it's not okay to use AI to impersonate a company or a government agency to start getting at how AI can be used to exacerbate fraud. So each one is a small example, but they actually change outcomes for people. And that's what gives me real confidence that we're making progress.
What would you love Congress to do? What's your secret plan?
Here's where we are on AI. This administration has gotten a lot of work done to lay the groundwork and to point us in the right direction for managing risks and to start doing the work to seize the really immense opportunities. On the benefit side, we have an industry that is going all out and is going to figure out between entrepreneurs and the big companies, they are going to figure out where the business opportunities are to drive productivity in business. As long as the market does that responsibly, we want that. That can be really, really good for our economy and for our country. It is not the only thing that we need AI for, because if we're going to change American health outcomes, if we're going to predict the weather better to deal with climate change, if we're going to educate our kids using more powerful tools that actually finally close educational gaps, we are going to need to harvest AI capabilities for all of these public purposes as well. So there's a boatload of work still to be done. And in my view, we are at the exact right time to go big. And that means solidifying the gains that have been made through the executive order. I think it's going to be important to build a stronger foundation with legislation under that. It also means making sure that we fund the research and development that it is going to take to meet these big public opportunities that are still ahead. We're doing enough today that you can see that it's going to be possible to design new drugs, not in decades, but potentially in months. Think about that. That's crazy. It's going to be possible, but we're not yet resourcing those R&D projects to drive there as fast as we need to.
How do you do that?
I think this is going to have to be something extraordinary. I want to back up, and we started by talking about government funding of R&D, right. But let me put it in context. So let me tell you what's going on. Here's the really good news, is American research and development spending, public sector and private sector together, is currently at 3.5% of GDP. That's phenomenal. It's a very healthy sign, even though China's spending in R&D has grown at just a breathtaking pace. It grew 27-fold in 25 years. Think about that. They are still not caught up with us, though. We're still number one. And the reason for that huge American position in R&D is purely because our industry has been expanding R&D much faster than the economy has been growing. They've been accelerating the percentage of GDP that they're spending. Government spending on R&D has barely kept up with the growth in the economy. And these are two things that we need both of. We absolutely want that industry spend because that's important for driving economic and market-driven opportunities. It can't continue to fully thrive if we don't keep this solid foundation of what the government does, the funding of university research, the training of students, the R&D for missions that the market's not going to deliver on, for example, national security and many aspects of health. The president, with the help of Congress, made some very good progress on government funding of R&D in the first couple of years of this administration. He actually was able to win 24% increase from about $160 billion to about $200 billion in 2 years. That's pretty good. And then we hit the budget caps in fiscal 24. And this is one of many things that did not get the funding that it really requires. So in the overall picture of American R&D, we have some real work to do on the government's share of that to make sure that we're playing our role in America's innovation and future. And a big part of that, in my view, is about seizing these AI opportunities. And that's going to need to get done through regular appropriations, through whatever other mechanisms we can find. If we don't seize this moment, there's no other country around the world that is sitting on its hands and waiting.
That's for sure. So maybe the national security, I don't think you guys have released the national security memorandum, the deeper dive in the works. Maybe that's
executive action. So we're going to do everything that we can do within the powers of the executive branch, but it's going to take much more. Yeah.
Speaking of that, so there's so much to ask you about, and I'm going to bounce around a lot.
Okay. Bounce. That's good.
So open source. So there's a lot of conversation with open source. You've got every VC that's ever walked by. We have someone from Andreessen Horowitz here. Stand up. That's here for Sydney. They're all looking around Meta, you know, you name it, Amazon. But how do you do open source in national security? Do you think there's a pathway to do that?
I think that's a very confused conversation. So let me say what I think about that. I spent a decade in early stage venture capital, and open source is so foundational to entrepreneurship. And we have gotten so much out of it that you really have to have a much more sophisticated conversation about this. So let's talk about it. Number one, I think, is when you look at AI technology, it's really important to recognize that there is the core technology itself, which has these very broad capabilities. If you think about the large language model that's powering a chatbot, the reason we're all agog about it is how broad its capabilities are. But then, separate from the model itself, is the actual application. Are you using it for a chatbot? Are you using it for customer service? Are you using it? Maybe it's not trained on language. Maybe it's trained on biological data. Are you using it to design drugs? These are all very, very, very different application areas. And the first place to start in managing AI's risks is to recognize that a lot of the things we don't want AI to be used to do happen to be already illegal. So it's already illegal to commit fraud. Our regulatory agencies have been very clear. They've said publicly, just because you're using AI to commit fraud does not mean you're off the hook. We're coming after you. And they've gone after people. So reinforcing things that are already illegal, fraud, discrimination in hiring and lending, these are all things where you don't need new laws. What you need is the ability for our regulators to be able to see and then enforce against AI accelerated harms in those particular applications. That has absolutely nothing to do with the core technology itself. It's in the applications that those harms manifest and have to be dealt with. So I think, again, as I mentioned, I think there are places where we're making progress there. I think that needs to remain the primary focus when we think about regulation of AI, is how to regulate its application when unintended consequences, or potentially intended consequences by an ad actor, are happening. So that can happen whether you're using a closed proprietary model or an open source model. I don't think it even gets to the open source issue. And then just really echoing your question, Tammy, my home's Palo Alto. When I'm home, I tend to go around and talk to a lot of investors and VCs and entrepreneurs. And the amount of excitement and the directions that people are taking this technology and the innovation in applications, often just drawing on the AI technology as a commodity, it's amazing to watch what's happening. Some of that's not going to work and some of it's going to be a very big deal. But open source is integral to that community and to that vibrant exploration. So I think it has to continue to be part of the mix.
Also, it's about time they all came here because Washington is the center of the universe, right? I'm sure you tell all your friends that. Yeah. Okay, the Paris AI Summit is coming up. What advice have you given Anne Bouverot on how to handle when they bring all these incredible companies and countries together? What's your advice?
Those safety summits, I think, have evolved in a really good direction. And I'll tell you, I give the vice president a lot of credit for that. The first one was sponsored by UK.
UK's here tonight.
The UK is here today. And when it started, I think it started, in my view, with an overly narrow focus on these sort of intangible existential risks of the future. And the vice president, in her speech in London just about a year ago right now, I think it was November last year, I thought just did a terrific job on the global stage laying out the fact that we need to deal with AI as it really is and with the risks and the harms that are manifesting for people today. And I think that has had the impact certainly on the AI safety work that's being done in the US, but I think is globally as well. And so when I've participated in some of the subsequent meetings, they have been broader in conceptualizing what we need to do. That's been helpful.
How much does DARPA advise companies on AI now?
Wow, I don't know. I don't think DARPA thinks that's really its role.
Right. No, I know it's not its role, but there's so much communication now. I mean, to me, one of the exciting things about all of this is that you've got companies, countries, governments sort of stepping out of their role, that they're reaching out their hand and talking about you should think about this or that. Maybe you guys can tell me I'm wrong.
I think every big thing that is happening and needs to happen is in the public sphere. And so it's the business of governments to make sure that we represent the public interest. And there are so many companies driving the technology. So I think that that's very much the case. Coming back to DARPA, what I will tell you is that what I saw from my time leading it a number of years ago is absolutely continuing, where you see very specific applications that are using AI in all kinds of creative ways. A lot of them are not large language models, which is, you know, where a lot of the hubbub is today about what's happening with generative AI. But I think those are areas where there's deep expertise, deep technical expertise, deep understanding of national security and military capabilities, and where they do interact with the industry, I think, in a very constructive way. But it's very two-way, right? We can't do what we need to do without a lot of open conversation with the industry technology leaders as well.
We're going to start taking questions in another couple minutes if you guys want to get ready for that. But that week of the UN General Assembly, in the run-up, we heard about the conversations that, you know, the announcements that were made, the people working together, AI for good. And then Sam Altman from OpenAI came out and said that superintelligence was going to happen, and he predicts, in about 1,000 days. So I want to ask you first about superintelligence.
I'm for it.
Okay, let's hear it. What's the date on that? Sam Altman says 1,000 days. What say you?
You know, I just actually think it's the wrong conversation. There are a lot of people in AI who are just so fascinated with, can you make a machine that does things that humans can do? I'm actually not that interested. The first time I had a machine that could do something better than I could do, it was my calculator. Like, I'm happy to see that. And I actually think a lot of this conversation about greater than human intelligence reveals a lack of understanding of what human intelligence actually is. We don't actually understand it. And so I think it's fine to have those conversations, but they do make me feel like I'm in a freshman dorm room at 2 a.m. So I like to stay in the real world.
Okay. Laura is first. House rules. You have to stand up, say your name and who you're with.
Hi, I'm Laura Tennyson. I'm with Booking Holdings. And looking at LLMs and Gen AI, do you think regulatory frameworks should differentiate responsibilities between the developers of those LLMs and the deployers? And if so, how?
I think it's exactly to this key point about applications of AI and then the core technology itself. Again, I think the applications, they're so broad that you have to take them one at a time in each domain. And there's a known regulatory framework. And now you have to figure out, how is AI going to exacerbate or improve the situation? Then how do we keep up with it? There are actually some very interesting domains. They're interesting intellectually, but I think they're going to be pretty challenging for companies. For example, intellectual property, right? Because we're now in a time in which this question of the IP that AI models are trained on is new territory for figuring out what is appropriate use of intellectual property. And right now we're on track to have that settled through a whole host of lawsuits over a period of time, patchwork. And that may be how that turns out. It could be something that Congress chooses to act upon. So when you think about applications and uses, I think there are many, many different categories. Many have known legal and regulatory frameworks that need adaption, perhaps, and then some are going to be new. And then I think the question of the core technology, the developers, that I think is just, like, I don't really know if anyone knows the answer to that. There's certainly a lot of exploration in our conversations in the executive branch and on Capitol Hill. There's a question of what would be effective. And when you think about the fact that what are the ingredients? It's still just compute data and algorithms. We've done some things to channel where compute capacity gets sold. And I think that's been helpful in dealing especially with potential adversaries around the world. But you just have to recognize that these are commodities that are largely available to everybody. And so it's a little bit like trying to hold water in your hand. So I think that's just a more complex and still open set of questions.
Okay, Eva.
Hi, Eva Doe, Washington Post. If you'd forgive a slightly topical question, sort of the big news in the news cycle in the past 24 hours in tech has been Elon Musk doing $1 million giveaway every day. I wanted to ask, first of all, what do you think of this guy? Like, what do you think of Elon Musk as a federal partner? And second, more broadly, how do you think of the balance between, you know, viewing major tech companies as a partner versus sort of the oversight role that the federal government has over them?
Yeah, I can't really answer the first half of that question because I'm here in my official capacity,
right,
obviously.
Of course. Have you met Elon Musk, first of all?
I have, yeah. I think the core question of how government works with industry, there's so many different dimensions to it. For sure, there are regulatory dimensions. But I think about everything I've ever done in my professional life, half of which has been in public service, and I did it in partnership with companies. That's how you make big things happen. Even if it starts in basic research in a university, if you want it to have impact in the world, almost always you're going to be partnering with a company. And I think government does have these different roles. In my view, it's very important to be very clear about which role you are in. For example, I used to run NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology. NIST has deep, long-standing, trusted relationships with industry. It is not a regulatory organization, and I think it's constitutionally incapable. It should never be a regulatory organization because it needs to play that trusted partnership role to develop measurements and standards and the basic infrastructure that makes everything in commerce work. That's very different for the FDA, and it's different again for DARPA that is doing R&D projects often with industry. I guess I would just come back to emphasizing clarity of which particular public mission is being pursued and not getting too confused about mixing them up.
My name is Carolyn Nihill. I'm with FedScoop. I had a question about the current state of federal research and development and was wondering if you could speak more to the state of R&D and if the next steps are for federal R&D to support internal federal innovation for AI or if you are looking towards more public-facing services for the American people to use.
Yeah, I don't think it's a choice. Let's talk about what would it look like if we were doing the government-funded R&D in AI that we need as a country to step up to this moment in time, this moment in geopolitics and this moment in technology. It would have multiple layers. The foundational layer would be compute and data infrastructure. I see Austin wearing his Nair t-shirt, and there's lots of Nair swag outside if anyone wants it. That's the National AI Research Resource, critically important. And a really important start that we need to make. I know there's movement on the Hill to get that authorized. What it's heading towards is authorizing $2.6 billion over 6 years. First of all, that is such a huge amount and so much better than $30 million, which is what NSF is currently doing. So for sure, let's get that done. But also take a minute and think about $2.6 billion over 6 years compared to how much it costs to build leading-edge AI models. Let's recognize that Nair needs to not only get authorized but appropriated, but then we need to do a lot more. That's just table stakes. That's just compute and data infrastructure. We need another layer that is a broad, deep foundation of basic research to support AI technology broadly for all applications. What are the fundamental underpinnings of scale? It's going to be about how do you assess safety and efficacy and effectiveness and trustworthiness. This is what our AI Safety Institute is doing today. But without that research base, we don't really have very good ways of assessing safety and effectiveness and trustworthiness. So research across a broad swath of AI capabilities is important. And then we need application layers for every public mission that requires AI. If we're going to design drugs and have the FDA be able to approve them 100 times faster than we're doing today, which actually could be possible, that's going to take deep research investment, deep partnership with industry to build that out, and obviously deep partnership with FDA.
Are you working with FDA on those issues?
I'll tell you, ARPA-H, the new ARPA Organization for Health, yay, that the president got launched. This was a major initiative. The president said, look what DARPA did for national security. We've got to do this for health. And it's such an important addition to what NIH does. ARPA-H just launched a program called Catalyst that is all about starting down this path. Exactly. But that's just health. Think about AI models can run weather forecasts 10 to 50,000 times faster than the physics-based models that we use today. The question in my mind is, what would it take for us to actually deliver a better weather forecast to all Americans? That's a different question. NOAA is starting to work on that over at the National Weather Service. So application after application after application, we're going to need to build out the R&D. And I'll just finish by saying one of the things that was in Majority Leader Schumer's framework that he put out with his bipartisan AI leadership group was $32 billion, endorsing a recommendation from the prior commission for $32 billion of non-defense AI R&D. And I think people look at that and they're like, 32, that's a lot of money. Let me tell you, if you want to go big and really do the country's work with AI, that's a great way to go. That's exactly the level at which we need to be tackling these problems.
Hi there. I'm Dylan Friedman with the New York Times. We see AI companies scaling tremendously, trying to build bigger and bigger LLMs. Purportedly because that's the path to superintelligence. But on the other side of the spectrum, you have critics who say that that's not actually, these LLMs are not actually reasoning. They are just pattern matching at scale. They're not able to actually generalize or invent new algorithms or other types of inventions. My question is, do you agree with this characterization? Do you think scaling up is this path to some form of superintelligence? And does this justify the building of nuclear power plants to facilitate large-scale AI operations?
Again, I'd like to separate the benchmarking of AI model capabilities to human intelligence, which again, I think benchmarking to something that we have a very fuzzy understanding of isn't that rigorous an exercise to begin with. I want to separate that from what I do see happening with advances in AI technology, which is greater and greater capability and often astonishing leaps in capability. I mean, I think we all had the wow moment of seeing a chatbot that actually could do all of these dramatic things. And those kinds of wow moments are happening over and over again in different domains. I don't live in the superintelligence world, but by saying that, I don't at all want you to take away that I don't think there's much going on here, because I think there's a lot going on, but it's practical. Your question was about scaling. By what I heard, I think in your question was more and more compute and larger models. Well, that's interesting. That's one dimension of how capabilities could continue to advance. And there are people who are making those investments. I want to give you two other critically important dimensions of how AI capability and therefore risk can advance. One is simply more compute. The other is training on different kinds of data. So when I talk about being able to design effective, safe drugs much more rapidly, I'm not talking about a large language model that reads a lot of biological research papers. You're just not going to get that far doing that. You can get a little ways. You can't get where you need to go. I'm talking about getting into and training on vast troves of biological and clinical data. By the way, it's all locked up in proprietary bins in different companies, so there are a few barriers. But when you can get at that kind of data and get people to come together and allow for training across that kind of data, then the power of the kinds of tools you're going to build there, I'm excited, as you can tell, about new drug development. I'm also quite worried about biological weapons capability. So it's always going to be bright and dark. So dimension number one is compute. Dimension number two is what kinds of data. And the third dimension is, what does your AI model, what kind of a system does it live in? And I'm particularly interested in when it lives in a system that takes automated action, whether it's in the online environment or the physical environment. I mean, a self-driving car is one of those, right? And when that kind of automation is tied to these expanding capabilities of the models, that's where I think it gets extremely interesting. People are out racing to do that, because that's where amazing opportunities are going to come. Big risks are also going to come with that.
When Ted Leonsis was here last week in Grandford Standing, they've gone to hospitals, cancer hospitals, all across the country, and they pulled all the information, actually exactly what you're talking about, for Zephyr AI and this other company, Tempus. But they cautioned that you shouldn't be talking about large language models, that people really need to start talking about large action models. That's what's really going to cause all these changes and all these gifts. Do you agree?
I just think we should think about a future with a plethora of different kinds of AI models. The way I think about it is, we live in the information age, and that means there's every kind of data you could possibly imagine. It comes off of sensors and scientific data. It comes in language. It comes in images. It comes off of, like, in the electrical grid, there's such a pile of data about what is happening to the electrons, what's happening with voltages and phases. So to me, when I think about AI, I think about it as a capability on top of just an infinite variety of different types of data.
Dylan touched a little bit on nuclear energy. Do you think that will be figured out in enough time to help the energy grid?
Well, we are at a moment where companies are racing to build big data, AI data centers. They need that electricity immediately, unlike the clean energy transition, where we're going to have a lot more electrical demand, but there are years to have it unfold. This is something we're spending a lot of time on at the White House, because it's either going to come out badly if we don't pay attention. We'll reverse on the great clean energy progress this president's been able to make. Or if we can get it right, it can actually help accelerate the clean energy transition, including nuclear, but other clean, firm sources of energy. That's the win-win that we really have to get to.
Is that a priority of the Energy Department?
It's a major focus right now in work that we're doing at the White House and with the Energy Department.
Austin, I think, is next. Oh, and then Corrali, you go first.
I'm Coralie van Hulten. I'm with the Netherlands Embassy, and I actually have a completely different question, a bit more basic maybe. You have a very impressive career, and I struggle sometimes explaining what's going on to people who are in policy to give sort of the big picture. What kind of advice could you give us, people that actually are in policy and working on it, to give advice to people who actually don't know what we are talking about?
I'll tell you a funny story. The phone rang one day and I had an urgent call from NASA, which is either going to be really good news or bad news. It turns out it was good news. Pam Melroy, who's the deputy administrator and with whom I had the great pleasure of working when we were both at DARPA together, a number of years ago. Pam says, there's a research paper that's about to be released, and I just wanted to give you a heads up. So a few hours later, the New York Times rolls out the news, and their headline captured it perfectly. It said, NASA is not saying it found life on Mars, but it is very excited about this rock. And the Mars rover had found a rock that had these little splotches on it that could be a biosignature, not just the conditions under which life could start, but actually something left behind billions of years ago by, you know, ancient microbial communities. So that was very cool. A few hours later, I found out that I needed to explain this in the Oval Office to my boss later that afternoon. And so I spent the next few hours learning all about the Mars Perseverance rover, learning about the Mars sample return mission, and learning how life starts. It was a heck of an afternoon. But you know, I'll tell you, every time I have one of these translation exercises, I'm talking to these NASA scientists, it's blowing my mind. It's so much fun. But I find that translating it to talk to someone who is blazingly smart but doesn't live in that scientific realm, it forces me to figure out what really matters. And I end up learning so much when I do that. So I don't think it's easy, but if you're going to make good policy, it's almost one of the core things, right, that we all have to do.
Thank you. Austin?
Austin Carson, founder and president of Seed AI. Two things. The first is, I mean, we've had like $200 billion in unfunded authorizations for the AND Science part, chips and science. We have the NAIR, which to your point, it's like we're operating at a very generous 140 or an actual $30 million. $2.6 billion is a good dream, but we all kind of know it should actually be like 10 to 50 billion or something. If you can have the choice of one or the other, would you either pick unlimited access to de-siloed data across the world, or would you pick unlimited compute?
Terrible choice. I reject your terrible choice.
Isn't it? And then
I reject it outright.
Then the second question is, if you could pick one thing that you could do and you had like blank check, there's 10 cards on the table of all the stuff we could do to make science move faster in the United States. But if you could pick one, and this could be one like get all the scientists to talk to each other together. It could be silly, but if you could pick one thing to do.
With the objective of making science move faster?
Making science move faster in a societally positive direction.
Okay, well, now I like it much better. Thank you. Thank you. Yes. I want to accelerate the good future that we all want. So, yeah, I will tell you, what would I do? I would make sure we're resourcing it. Right now, I'm most concerned that we are not resourcing the government-funded R&D at a level that would allow us to keep up with the scale of our ambitions. We should always be the most ambitious country on the planet. And we are. We are. But we have to deliver on that, including with R&D.
Okay, two more quick questions. Okay, go ahead.
Hi, Olivia with Amazon Web Services. Speaking of funding, and we're not giving enough, I think one way to really look at it, and you can tell me if you agree or not, is that the CHIPS and Science Act got $50 billion, a one-time essential payment of $50 billion for chips. If you look at the big tech companies, Amazon, Google, et cetera, Microsoft, there will be about $100 billion just spent this year on development. So how do we, as registered lobbies, talk to members of Congress about how we do need to make sure this APROPES funding is matching the scale, you know, because this is a bipartisan, bicameral issue that we want to remain global leaders in the space, especially against our adversaries. So how do we encourage, as we engage on the Hill politically, to make it not a political issue or a win for a particular side, but just what's in the core need of our country?
This is so important. And I really want to emphasize something you said, because I think it's vitally important. There is so much that we disagree about in this country today, but agreeing that we need to make the investments for our future and supporting R&D is actually something that has very broad appeal and commitment and interest. I can't find a member of Congress who doesn't agree with what you said. They realize why it's important in our geopolitics for our national security, for economic opportunity for people in their districts and their states. So this is not the case of people are gunning for it, by and large. This is the case of the urgent always supersedes and takes, you know, shoves aside things that are very important. When I look at what happened in the fiscal 24 budget process, after very important, substantial, meaningful growth for 2 years in government-funded R&D, the estimates are potentially as much as a 10% reduction in federally funded R&D for non-defense R&D between 23 and 24. The same week we passed those appropriations bills in the United States that did that, The PRC announced that they were going to increase their government spending in R&D by 10%, of which there's a 13% growth in basic research. Footnote, it used to be China just copied and followed. That is not what we're dealing with anymore. So, of course, we should continue to protect our intellectual property. But when you've got your own basic research, that's not the only way you can progress. And if we don't run harder and faster, we're just not going to get where we need to go. So that's sort of the bigger picture situation. And I think when the election's over, they'll come back and they're everyone will be focused on appropriations and keeping the government going. There may be a spectrum bill. I think that's looking like it's promising. We're all very hopeful that there will be a spectrum reauthorization. That, yay, absolutely. That in itself will be a big thing. Its proceeds, part of that might get designated for NIST and NSF, which were two of the important pieces of and science that didn't get funded. So those are all very promising opportunities, but making sure that people remember to keep R&D as a priority, that's very much where we're focusing our work right now.
Okay, one more question.
Thank you. Rami Lur from the Special Competitive Studies Project. You mentioned that we're not always having the right conversations. How can we ensure that policymakers are having the right conversations and engaging in evidence-based policymaking?
The first time I heard the term evidence-based policymaking, I said, like, what else do you base policy on? But the fact is, there are things that are so hard that for a long time we didn't have evidence. And so we used our best guess about how to educate our kids. Or classic example, we used our best guess about how to do drug education to get kids to not start doing drugs. It was called a program called DARE. Well, it turns out when you actually evidence, it turns out it doesn't work. And so then maybe you should change your mind and do something different. So I actually think that's an important movement across policy. And to me, it's a reflection of the power of really effective social science put to work. That's a whole nother topic. That's another thing that's coming out of federal R&D that really is going to make a difference. But I think people respond to the evidence of we did this research and this is how the world changed. When I go talk to people on the Hill, I tell them about, I'll tell you my mRNA story since you asked or you almost asked. So a decade ago, let's see, it's 2012. I show up to run DARPA. I hadn't been at DARPA for 19 years. So I'm getting acquainted with my amazing program managers. One of my program managers who is, you'll love this. He's an epidemiologist, an infectious disease doc, a geneticist, and an Air Force colonel because it's DARPA.
As one does.
And Dan says, this 2012, he says, we're going to have another pandemic. All the conditions are ripe. Many problems if that happens. One of the problems that I want to go after is we don't know how to make a vaccine in fewer than years or decades or never. And he says, but there's this amazing research in mRNA, and it might be the basis for a rapid response vaccine platform. And today we're all like, but of course, that's obvious. That was the craziest idea you could imagine. Everyone, all the experts told Dan he was crazy. The word naive got used many a time, okay? It's like it was nutty at that time. And then Dan says, I just met this little company in Boston. It's called Moderna. It just started up, and they're working on mRNA, but they're interested in cancer. And I think we might be able to persuade them to work on infectious disease, which we did, because when you have vision and dollars, amazing things can get done, let me tell you. So I tell that story because, number one, because without federally funded research, we wouldn't be where we are today. But number two, this is a perfect example of the government doing what it needs to do, right? Like, we cared about infectious disease when that was not a market. And then companies doing what they need to do. They're the ones that actually commercialized it, that did the manufacturing, that worked with NIH when NIH got on board. And then the government came in and got shots into arms.
Arthi, thank you so much.
Thank you all.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for the work you do. Thank you for your commitment. Thank you for your passion. Thank you for being here with us at the Washington AI Network.
What a pleasure. Thank you, Tammy. Thanks all.
Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.